Welcome to week 12 of Megillat Esther. We are motoring through. I expect to wrap up Perek Hey, to wrap up chapter 5 today. That at least is the goal. Once again, I thank Dana and Ilan Rubinstein for dedicating our series. We started Perek Hey. We started chapter 5 last time with the theme of divine control of events, highlighted especially by the Haman's rise and fall, how he first becomes the Mishneh LaMelech viceroy, and then everybody bows to him, and then he can issue a decree with the king's ring, and the queen invites him to a party with the king, and finally the king in the next chapter is going to ask what he can do for the person the king wants to honor, which Haman thinks is himself. And then it all comes crashing down, and it's just such a neat structure, the build-up and then the fall, as well as, what we noted, the way that the events in the Megillah occur in pairs. So Esther has two visits to Ahasuerus that are recorded, Esther has two parties, Haman has two family meetings, Haman has two meetings with Ahasuerus, and how in each of these pairs, there's a transition where they become opposite experiences. I'm not going to go through the whole thing now. We did it last time. You can catch the recording if you missed it. Somebody emailed me in the course of the week to ask, well, what does all of this divine control do to the concept of free will? And the answer is, it's a very good question, particularly when this week we are reading about in the Torah the hardening of Paro's heart. And that, of course, raises the free will question. But there are really two basic answers that I know of at any rate. Answer number one is that God has the ability to choose what you can choose between. So it may be true that given a set of options, I can choose which option I want, but God is the one who is setting up the playing field and will decide which options I have in the first place. So if God wants me to go a certain direction, you know, if you want your child to eat something healthy, the first thing that you have to do is remove all the other things from the table. That's the surest way to make sure that that they end up eating the healthy thing instead of the unhealthy thing. That may not be the best way to parent, but it's the best way to get the result that you want. That's in terms of, that's one answer, is God chooses what your options are. The other, a little more fraught, is that God can change the rules as God chooses. If there is an overriding value, if there's an overriding purpose, we do know that God will, at times, play with people's free will, even though free will is such a fundamental part of Judaism. Nonetheless, Paro, as an example, many of the commentators explain that God hardens Paro's heart because he has a very specific goal in mind, and it's more important than Paro's free will. But that's its own discussion for another time. Let's go to what we're going to do next, which is, from chapter 5, sentence 4, lessons for strategies of Jews in exile. Take a look, please, at Pasuk Dalet, sentence 4, where Esther speaks to Ahasuerus at the first party. So, first of all, Ahasuerus asked Esther, what do you want? Right? We're actually before the first party, sorry. Ahasuerus asked Esther, what do you want? Up to half of the kingdom. The whole half of the kingdom thing is one of those things that I would love to discuss, but we're not going to. But Vatomer Esther ima ha-melech tov. Esther says, if it's good in the eyes of the king, Yavo ha-melech ve-haman hayom el ha-mishteh asher asisi lo. Let the king and Haman come today to the party that I have made for him. So that's Esther's request, is she wants Ahasuerus and Haman to show up at her party. So take a look at source number one on your sheet, please, from Professor Amos Chacham in the Dot Mikra edition. He asks the question of why there's a whole party thing at all. Why is there a party? Why isn't it just, Ahasuerus says, what do you want? And she says, they want to kill my people. Where is this party idea coming in? So take a look at source number one, please. Professor Chacham writes, V'nirah, it appears, Shebe'omda lefnei ha-melech, when she stood before the king, Hitkavna Esther lahat'ot et Ahasuerus. Esther wanted to trick Ahasuerus. Sheyachshov shehamalka marat nefesh al asher zeh shloshim yom lo nikra lavo al hamelech. She wants Ahasuerus to think that she's broigus, right? She wants Ahasuerus to think that she is upset. Hey, you know, I've been hanging out here in the palace. It's been 30 days, and you haven't summoned me. And what she wants is for the king to try to appease her. And give her honor. And he'll come to the party that she has arranged. She should come to him along with the highest officer he has. It's a strategy of putting the king on the defensive. Now, Amos Chacham is saying this in response to a view that he rejects. There are those who suggest that the party was actually a stalling tactic. That what Esther initially planned to do was to go to Ahasuerus and say to him, they want to kill my people. And that she didn't do it because she gets in front of Ahasuerus and she freezes. That's one school of thought. Amos Chacham does not like that idea at all. And his argument is, if you take a look at the language in Pasuk Dalet in sentence 4, she says, they should come el hamishteh asher asiti lo, to the party that I have prepared. It sounds like it's already prepared. So before she ever walked in the door, she had already set up the food, the wine, and, you know, it's all there already. So he says the idea was to put him on the defensive, which isn't a bad strategy. But that's point number one, is that she's strategizing, and it's not just a panic move. Susan, you were going to say?
How does having him at a party put him on the defensive? I'm sorry, I don't understand that.
So the whole idea of summoning the king and summoning Haman to come to a party is an aggressive move. Right? What's the motivation behind it? That's what he's reading. He's looking at it and saying, this whole notion is essentially Esther saying, number one, I want your company. But number two, I also want status. Otherwise, why is Haman there? It's more than just wanting Ahasuerus' company. Now, we're going to talk about why she invites Ruchama Rakshniya. We're going to talk about why she invites Haman. But as Amos Chacham reads it, it's part of a strategy to make Ahasuerus feel like he's been neglecting her inappropriately. That's the idea. Ruchama and then Joyce.
When he said to her, "At chatziyam alchut v'de'as," and we know, "Me'ay sim v'sheva medinot," chatziyam alchut would include Eretz Yisrael.
So, right. So, like I said before, I'm not talking about the Ad Chatziyah Malchut. There is so much that you could say about it. But like I said in the beginning of the year, if we're going to do every piece of Megillat Esther, then we're never going to touch anything else, which isn't a bad thing. But we did pitch this idea of doing Esther, Ruth, and Echa, and I intend to try to stick as close as possible to it. But it's a good question what Ad Chatziyah Malchut means. That's what I'll say to you, Joyce. You were going to say?
I was going to ask a question.
Yeah.
In the English translation that I have prepared for him, why is it not for them?
So hang in there, because that is something we're going to talk about. If you look at number 3 on your sheet, 5-4 versus 5-8, that's where we're going to come back to it. So it's a good question. Hang in there. So again... what we see, first of all, is Amos Chacham making the point that Esther is strategizing. This party is planned. Whether you buy the idea that it's putting Ahasuerus on the defensive or not is really beside the point. The point is that there actually is a strategy here. And now what I want to show you next is this very long piece on your source sheet in source number 2. There isn't much in this source that is novel, but I'm bringing it in order to show you that in the eyes of the Gemara, Esther's first move that she made, telling them, we should have everybody fast for me, is a religious move. But her plan is fundamentally grounded in practicality. as far as the Gemara is concerned, Esther's plan is not just let's rely on God, but rather it's a practical move. The Gemara in Megillah, in source number 2, asks why Esther invited Haman, and as you'll see, it offers a dozen different answers. Now, I rearranged, as noted on the sheet, I rearranged this Gemara. This is not the order in which the 12 answers appear. If you were to open a standard Gemara. The reason why I did that is because you can actually group the answers into 5 different kinds. And I rearranged it in order to put them that way so that it becomes easier to understand. Otherwise, someone tells you, here are 12 answers for why she invited Haman, you get completely lost. So what I did was just to rearrange it in order to group like answers with like. You follow? Okay. So the first 3 answers that are there on the page, Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Yehuda, are essentially all saying that Esther invites Haman in order to enable possibilities for herself, to make sure to keep her options open. So Rabbi Eliezer's view, I'm not going to read it word for word, you can see my translation there on the page, and the original Hebrew. But Rabbi Eliezer says she sets up a trap for him. Not a trap like what ends up happening where she tells Ahasuerus, but just hoping that he's going to make a mistake. Bring Haman to a party with Ahasuerus, open up bottles of wine, and hope that Haman does the work for me. Essentially, is Rabbi Eliezer's perspective, quoting a pasuk from Tehillim, in which the table is described as a trap for the wicked. Rabbi Yossi offers a similar idea, which is, just make sure Haman is going to be around, and again, as Rashi explains on that, so that she'll be able to make him slip somehow. Have him around. Rabbi Yehuda adds a third component to this, which is, so that people won't realize she's Jewish. Haman decreed that all the Jews should be destroyed. Esther is inviting Haman. No one's going to suspect that she has anything against Haman until it's too late. So she's doing this, according to those first 3 approaches, as a means of keeping her options open. That's the idea. Until she, in the end, tells Ahasuerus what's going on. The second set of approaches includes Rabbi Meir, Rabbah, and Rabbi Yehoshua. And these take the view, which I think is most common, that she is manipulating Haman. So Rabbi Meir says she wants to lull him into complacency so he isn't going to realize that she's working against him. If she invites him to the party, he assumes she likes him. Right? Guys are really, really, simple. They're not complicated. She invited him to the party. Oh, she must like him a lot. That's the way that their logic works. That's Rabbi Meir's view of it. Rabbah amplifies that and says it's to make him arrogant. And Rabbah quotes the sentence from Mishlei, from Proverbs, very well known, Lifnei Shever Gaon, pride goeth before the fall. Right? He becomes very arrogant, and that's going to, in the end, cause him to fall. And Rabbi Yehoshua says, she takes a different sentence from Mishlei. Im ra'ev son acha, if your enemy is hungry, feed him bread. Feed your enemy, in other words. And the idea being, feed your enemy, and again, then your enemy won't be your enemy in the future. People like food. That's basically the lesson out of this. Side note, if you look at Rabbi Yehoshua in the Gemara, it says that she learned this from her father's house. That's odd because she doesn't have her father, right? Mordechai ends up raising her. So Rabbi Shlomo Halevi Al-Kabetz in the Manot Halevi commentary to Megillat Esther suggests that it means that Mordechai taught her the method of looking at psukim, looking at passages from Tanakh for practical guidance. So she draws this from Mishlei. So our first school of thought, basically, and again, we had these different sub-answers, was Esther invites Haman in order to keep her options open. Maybe things will develop well. Your second is manipulate Haman. Make him complacent, make him arrogant, make him think of himself as an ally. So far, so good? Okay. Third school of thought includes three other answers. So we're now at Rabbi Yoshua ben Karcha, Rabbi Elazar HaModoi, and Rabbi Gamliel. And that is manipulating Achashverosh. Okay, that's also a very popular idea. She invites Haman in order to manipulate Achashverosh. Meaning what? So Rabbi Yoshua ben Karcha gives a very dramatic read. Rabbi Yoshua ben Karcha says this was a suicide mission. She wants Achashverosh to suspect that something is going on between Esther and Haman and to kill both of them. That's what she's setting up. So says Rabbi Yoshua ben Karcha. Worth noting, by the way, this would be an interesting thing to study. I didn't really think about it beforehand. I'm just thinking about it now. Rabbi Yoshua ben Karcha, that name, Yoshua ben Karcha, may well be a pseudonym. Tosfos suggests that it might actually be a pseudonym. Anybody happen to know what Rabbi Yoshua ben Karcha's real name might have been? Anybody know the story? Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Yoshua ben Karcha may well have been Rabbi Akiva, and even among those who say he was not Rabbi Akiva, they suggest he's Rabbi Akiva's son. The idea being that Rabbi Akiva was bald, and Karcha is a reference to somebody who is bald. Kereach. So I'm just suggesting mildly, just, you know, as I'm thinking about it, that Rabbi Yeshua ben Karcha, / Rabbi Akiva or Rabbi Akiva's son, is well aware of the price of rebellion against the Romans. Right? Rabbi Akiva is murdered by the Romans. Rabbi Akiva is also involved in attempts to rebel against the Romans. He is the major supporter among the rabbis of Bar Kokhba and his revolt. There's even a whole discussion about two different schools among the rabbis. Rabbi Gamliel on the one side saying we should make nice to the Romans and live with what they do, and Rabbi Akiva saying no, we should be revolting against the Romans. So the mentality of even if it costs us our lives that you see with Rabbi Akiva, I wonder if you're seeing that in this answer about what Esther was doing. She was willing to put her life on the line, not to put her life on the line, set herself up to be killed if it's also going to result in the death of Haman. Just a suggestion.
Haman is dead. How would it feel the decree went out?
So I think the idea is that without Haman, the decree loses its steam. I think that's the idea. It doesn't play out that way in the Megillah. But that's what Rabbi Yoshua ben Karcha seems to be suggesting. Yeah. There's a note in the chat. Doesn't Rabbi Akiva think that Bar Kokhba was the Mashiach? Yes, that's part of his support for Bar Kokhba. That is correct. The other two ideas that go along with this, that she's manipulating Achashverosh, Rabbi Elazar HaModoi suggests it's just an attempt to make Achashverosh and his officers jealous of Haman's success, and again, in the hope that somebody's going to bring him down. And then Rabbi Gamliel says it's because she knows Achashverosh's moods. One day he's angry, the next day he's not angry. One day he likes you, the next day he doesn't like you. He loves Esther, and then he goes 30 days without even seeing her. He's angry and he has Vashti killed and then he calms down. So Esther is worried. I spring the trap on Haman at the party. Achashverosh is livid. But Haman's not there. Time passes before we can get Haman executed and Achashverosh changes his mind. So therefore I want Haman at the party in order that Achashverosh will kill him right away. Or at least give the order for his execution right away. Which is, you know, what happened. So far we've seen, keep Haman there so you have options. Bring Haman there in order to get him to think he's an ally or to be arrogant and to be complacent, and then you'll be able to trap him. manipulate Ahasuerus and his officers, make them jealous, make Ahasuerus think something is wrong, or just to ensure that Ahasuerus does not flip-flop. Clear? Okay. Gita.
Going back to the second idea that you had.
Yeah.
I'm confused because you label it as a way of befriending Haman, and yet one of the ones was to get him very angry.
To get Ahasuerus angry. To make Haman angry. To make Ahasuerus angry.
Okay. Sorry. Never mind.
Okay. No problem. No problem. I know I am going through this a little bit quickly, and that's largely because I think if I had polled you beforehand about why Esther invited Haman, you would have come up with most of these. Like, I don't think that that's adding all that much. It's more just I want you to see the specific point that I introduced this with, which is that the perspective of the Gemara is that Esther is taking practical steps. Even though she began religiously, let's get everybody to fast and pray to God, when it comes to actually doing something, it's not all about, well, I'll just pray to God and then it'll all be okay. She is coming up with plans, and not just one plan, but we're suggesting all these different versions of what her plan was. And we have more. The kicker is going to come at the end, but don't jump there. Rabbi Nechem, yes, Janine.
I just wanted to ask, when I talked about jealousy, I think I read someplace, was she possibly trying to arouse Ahasuerus' jealousy to think that there was something going on between her and Haman?
Yeah, no, that's Rabbi Yeshua ben Karcha.
Well, okay. Because the other one was more, he would be jealous of his power, but there was also a kind of...
Right, no, this is what it looks like. Which is why when Haman falls on the bed, it's, you know, he says, what in the world do you think you're doing? When he, you know, that's absolutely what Rabbi Yeshua ben Karcha is saying. Yes. Yeah. One of the tricks when you read Gemara is just that the Gemara loves pronouns. And you have to know who the hims are on all these lines. So in Rabbi Yeshua ben Karcha's line, I will show favor to him. Him is Haman. In some of my classes, I've started to just take out pronouns and put in names, even though it's not a literal translation, because this gets so confusing for people. Rabbi Nechemya takes a different tack. Rabbi Nechemya is more towards a religious strategy. Rabbi Nechemya says, the Jews, like we said last time, are all thinking, we have Esther on our side, she's in the palace, you know, she is going to take care of us. She doesn't want that. So she invites Haman to the party with the idea that everyone is going to know. How everyone's going to find out, I don't know. But everyone is going to find out that Haman was invited to the party, and they're going to think that she has turned. That's why Rabbi Nechemya says it. She doesn't want the Jews to rely on her to save them. That's the way that the Rabbi Nechemya reads it. Then if they rely on her, they're going to stop davening. So she says, let them not think that I'm going to be the one to take care of them. And then last school of thought, Rabbi Shimon ben Manasseh and Abaye and Rava. We've seen the view that she's manipulating Haman. We've seen the view that she's manipulating Ahasuerus. We've seen that perhaps she's manipulating the Jews. Well, the last school of thought says she's manipulating God. Either, I knew you'd like that, Gita. Either Rabbi Shimon ben Manasseh says, so that God will see this and perform a miracle. Meaning God is going to see that I am degrading myself this way, that I'm drawing Haman close, and because of that, God will be moved to perform a miracle. That's one. Or Abaye and Rava point out Yirmiyahu's prediction. Yirmiyahu made a statement which comes true with Belshazzar, that last Babylonian king. He gets killed at his feast. So God punishes the wicked at their feasts. So she thinks, I'm going to set up a feast. God likes to punish people at their feasts. And then I'll set up so God will punish Haman. It works. So the key line in all of this to me is the last line. Ashkeche Rabba Baravua le Eliyahu. Rabba Baravua, who is an Amora, he's a sage from the time of the Gemara. He encounters Eliyahu, Elijah the prophet, just like that. Amarle, and he says to him, you know, I had a question I've been wondering about, because what else do you do when you encounter Eliyahu, is you ask him whatever questions are on your mind. He says, Kiman Chazya Esther va'abdahachi. What did Esther see that made her decide to do this? What was Esther's strategy about? Why did she invite Haman? To which Amarle, Eliyahu replies, Kechulu tanoi ukechulhu amorai. They're all correct. Esther was playing a multi-layered chess game. It wasn't one strategy. It was everything you can think of. All the answers that all your sages have thought of. Yeah, Esther anticipated all of them. She was playing this game on every possible level. Which speaks obviously to respect for Esther. But it also speaks to a philosophy that says, you have to try everything. You don't say, well, we're doing a 3-day fast, and that's it. You have to come up with every strategy and try everything. Yes, Bruria.
It just seems to me that Ahasuerus really is eager to please Esther beyond what he was until now. But it's like suddenly he just turned and does everything she wants him to do. It's like he's falling right into the trap.
Right. I mean,
it wouldn't be for him being so nice to her. He even says to Haman, hurry to the feast. Like, what's the rush?
Right. On the other hand, Ahasuerus doesn't really need an incentive to go to a party.
No, but he seems to be so favorably towards Esther, like never before. I haven't seen her in 30 days, and all of a sudden he's all over.
The two may go together. But if I take Amos Chacham's perspective, right? If I take Amos Chacham's view that Esther was putting him on the defensive, right? I haven't seen you for 30 days. Wouldn't you at least show up to my party? Maybe he does feel like that.
He's going all the way.
Yes.
In the direction to please her.
Right. But again, I don't think he needs convincing to go to parties. I think this is, this is the identity that's presented us. Yeah.
Okay.
Maybe he's telling Haman, I don't want to delay. The longer you wait to get to the party, the later we start drinking. I don't know. Yes, Debbie.
Is any of this sexual? If she hasn't seen him for 30 days, she hasn't been sleeping with him, right?
I expect that's true.
Hello? Is that?
Yeah,
her?
No, that...
Why did he choose her? Because she was cute? No, because he wanted to sleep with her. So isn't that the only... I mean, we sort of skirt around all these things because, sapasnish, to my friends who speak Yiddish. But it seems to me it's a very sexual kind of move. Gonna get him drunk, gonna have a big party.
So it sounds like a distinct possibility. As you read this chapter, it does lend itself towards that. Specifically when at the party, Ahasuerus says to Esther, so now what do you want? And her answer is, come to the party tomorrow, and then I will do as the king says. So there's definitely a possible component like that, mixed in with Rabbi Yehoshua ben Karcha's point that she's trying to make him think there's something going on between her and Haman. So, I think the layer is there. I think the layer is there. You're correct, though. It's a passionate.
The layer is there all throughout with Esther.
I mean, look, the layer is there from the beginning of the Megillah and the story with Vashti.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
And we never mentioned that,
We mentioned it. Sure we did.
That's one of the powers that women have over men, or this woman has over this man.
Yeah. Okay. Sure. So, I want to start talking about the second party, but questions and comments on this first. Yes, Jeanette.
So, it appears to me that no matter whose point of view you like in the Gemara, or all of them, the way you just said, it feels like what Esther is doing here is basically she learned the lesson that Mordechai was giving her. When he said to her, and she's balancing those two things. In other words, you know, talk about the balance between between Bechira and action, is that, you know, Hashem's going to do his part, but what does he want from me? And she starts off with the spiritual. She starts off with, you know, giving it over to Hashem. But then, and I love the last one, just saying, I'm going to do my hishtadlus. I'm going to do whatever I can possibly think of, every strategy I can do. And beyond that, you know,
yeah,
it's in Hashem's hands. So yeah. she got what Mordechai was the lesson that he was giving her.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think it is true. Additional comments? Okay, then let's move on, because there's so much more going on in this chapter. Take a look, please, at Pasuk Chet, sentence 8. This is at the first party. Achashverosh says to Esther in Pasuk Vav, in sentence 6, Achashverosh says to Esther, what would you like? It will be given to you. What request do you have? Up to half of the kingdom, it'll be done. And then in Pasuk Zion, in sentence 7, you get this very dramatic sentence, which, by the way, is the midway point in the Megillah, is this line. Vatan Esther Vatomar, Esther declares and she says, and you can see the tension building, right? And Esther declared, and she said, She'ela si, my request. Uvakasha si, also my request. Malbim has distinctions between She'ela and Bakasha, I'm not doing right now. Im matzasi chen ve'enei hamelech. If I have found favor in the eyes of the king. Ve'im al hamelech tov. And if it's good for the king. La'seisa she'ela si, to give me what I ask. V'la'sosis bakasha si, to fulfill my request. And you're like, how long are we going to have to go before she actually says, Haman, bad man. Yavo Hamelech v'Haman el Mishtasher es Elohem. Let the king and Haman come to the party. I'm going to make for them, and then tomorrow I'll do what the king says. It's just like, you know, I wish I could remember what it was like to hear this story for the first time. It's got such a dramatic buildup, and especially when you lane it, the way the pauses work, the way the notes work, I mean, just to do that, because I think it's worth it to think through the way it sounds. Vatan Esther vatomar she'ela si uvakasha si im matzah si chein be'enei hamelech ve'im al hamelech tov laseis es she'ela si v'la asos es bakasha si. You go through all of that since the time that Achashverosh said to her, what do you want? You go through all of that build-up until she finally says, Yavo Hamelech v'Haman. Let the king and Haman come to the party. It's just like, crash. Why a second party? What is the second party for? You tell me, before we see where we're going to go with this, why does she want a second party? What would you say? Besides stalling.
Everything she planned is now going to get me even more stressed.
Meaning? Meaning? You're right, but what is, spell that
more
out
jealousy,
a little.
More jealousy, more.
Yes. More. All the things that she's trying to create, Achashverosh's suspicion of Haman, Haman's complacency, the people thinking Esther has abandoned them, all the different answers that we gave in source number 2 are now intensified. That's a way to approach this. Professor Yonatan Grossman notes something, and this is Joyce's question from before. I told you we'd come back to it, and we came back to it. Compare, please, sentence 4, her initial invitation, with sentence 8, and the way she describes the party in each one. What's the difference between the way she describes the party in sentence 4 and the way she describes the party in sentence 8?
First, she says,
bingo. In the first time round, Professor Grossman notes, she says, come to the party, the king, and Haman, come to the party I made for him. Which the king can safely assume means him is the king. However, in sentence 8, she says, the king and Haman should come to the party I made for them. You don't think Achashverosh is wondering about that?
No,
Now she's making parties for Haman. As a matter of fact, the Gemara builds on that in source number 4 to explain something at the start of chapter 6. Right? The beginning of chapter 6, Achashverosh can't sleep. Why can't he sleep? So take a look at the Gemara here in source number 4. Nafla le milsa bedaite. A thought fell into his mind. Amar, he said, Maidik Haman, dezabinte Esther la Haman. What is this that she invites Haman? Dilma eitza kashakli ilaveda hu gavra lemikdale. Perhaps they are plotting to kill that man. That man is himself. The third person is standard in the Gemara, especially if you're dealing with someone of royalty. So Ahasuerus can't sleep because she invited him to a second party with Haman, and he says something's wrong. So that's one way to read the need for a second party is a practical benefit. She wants to intensify all the things that she's been that she developed with the first party. That's one school of thought. Second school of thought, Malbim. He says, look again at the way that Esther develops this. What does Ahasuerus want her to do? Leave aside Devi's point about what Ahasuerus wants her to do. But just within the literal text, what does Ahasuerus want Esther to do at this party?
Wants half the kingdom or whatever she wants.
Correct. Ahasuerus wants her to make a request. So take a look at Malbim in source number 5. The Hebrew is at the bottom of one side and the English translation top of the next side. He enena kidai levakesh davar min hamelech. Esther says, I am not worthy of requesting something from the king. Aval achar shehamelech pakad aleh shetavakesh menu davar. But since the king is asking me to make a request, he needs a vakesh bakasha, so she'll make a request. K'dei l'kayim dvar hamelech ufkudaso, to fulfill the word of the king and his command, shorotzeba zeshet vakesh, that he wants her to make a request. It's not for myself. I'm doing this because the king wants it. If she makes the request at the first party, it's her initiative to ask for something. But if there's a second party, now it's, you asked me to make a request. So therefore she is doing this to make the king happy. That's a second school of thought. She's put the shoe on the other foot. Yes, Joyce.
This is the first time that Haman is described as joyful and with a glad heart.
Oh, you caught me. I wasn't there yet. Trying to see which source it is that we're going to bring this in. I said it last week. Did I say it? No, I say it is this week. Where is it? Hang on one second.
You did mention it last week.
I did mention it?
Yeah.
Okay. I did mention it last week. But yes, one of the commentators says, Vayetze, I think it's Shlal David, Rav David Zinsheim, says, Vayetze Haman Bayom Hahu Sameach V'Tov Lev, Bayom Hahu, he was Sameach V'Tov Lev. He's happy for the first time when he gets invited to that party. Haman is a very hard man to please. But Ibn Ezra floats a third idea for why she wants to have another party. He has a religious idea behind it. He says Esther is waiting for a sign from God. She isn't ready to pull the trigger. She wants a sign that she should do it. So if you take a look at source number 6, Ibn Ezra. Ulefi da'ati, in my view, she'ichara Esther ledaber bayom rishon b'mishtei hayayin, Esther stalled. She didn't speak on that first day. Ba'avur shalora ata shum ot shechideish Hashem ba'avur ta'anit Yisrael, because she saw no sign that God was doing anything different, that the fast had worked. V'kasher asa bayom ha'sheni devar gedulat Mordechai. But then, before the second party, Mordechai gets paraded around the city on the horse. Now she says, at that point she says, okay, now we're ready. She has received the message that God is helping. So she was waiting for a divine message. You can imagine that she could have gone on for days like this, with party after party after party, waiting for a sign. But it's a very interesting note that Ibn Ezra puts in here. So three ideas for why there should be a second party. Number one, to intensify what she had accomplished with the first one. Number two, so that now she's making a request because the king said that she should. Or number three, because she's waiting for some sign that things are going to break the way of the Jews instead of for Haman. Yes, Susan?
I don't understand how the sign, like how is that a sign?
Because until now, the Jews are the ones who are going to get killed. Now, Mordechai HaYehudi is being paraded around on the horse, given all the honors of the kingdom. So, one second, Rakshniya Chana, Susan, what?
Haman was still planning to kill Mordechai, even the hanging thing was up and all of that, what do you call it? You know, when you hang.
Yeah, the gallows.
Thank you. The gallows was up. But this was from the king, and so she interpreted the dressing up because.
As a sign that things are going to be good.
This night.
Yeah. And she's right. And she's right, because we know the way it plays out in chapter 7, right? When Harvona says to the king, you know, Haman wants to kill Mordechai, the guy you really like, that's when the king says, all right, off with his head. So she's right for reading that sign. Chana, what were you going to say?
And actually, Zeresh is saying it exactly. She says, that's it.
Yes, we have to get to Zeresh. She's an interesting one.
But she
yes.
knows the effect.
Yes. Okay.
She reminds me of Amalek, because Amalek also recognizes when the Jews are up and when they're down.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting.
And if Amalek is from Amalek, she's too.
That's a very interesting idea. I hadn't thought about it, but the canniness is there. I'm going to jump ahead to Pasuk Yudalit, sentence 14. And now we're going to talk about Zeresh. But it's not really about Zeresh so much. It's about this 50 amma tall piece of wood and a very odd midrash. The message that we're going to look at overall is that galut enables ge'ula. Exile enables return. That the point of having to be in exile is in order to do things that, to experience things that, will bring us back to Eretz Yisrael. You could discuss for a very long time, with sources on all sides, what the goal is of Galut. Why do we go into exile? What was the reason for going into exile? What would you say? We're not going to make this a long discussion, but what would you say? What's the reason why God sends the Jews into exile?
As I said, that we didn't follow all the rules with the Beit HaMikdash and everything, and God was punishing us for not following His ways.
Right.
And then we'll learn in Galut what we lost.
Right. So one approach is that it's punishment, punishment/.
It's also kurituch. Like
yes.
It purifies us.
Right. So I'm going to get to Chana's point in a moment. The first approach is it's punishment. Or, along with that, we're unworthy of the land of Israel. Right? You see that in Chumash. You see that in Tanakh. You see that in passages in the Gemara that ask why God did this and this sin and that sin and the other sin. One idea is that we are unworthy of the land, and therefore we're going to be punished. And along with that, you could add Chana's point that there are things that we're supposed to learn by being in exile. There are things that we're supposed to, that we're supposed to benefit from in that experience. That's certainly a school of thought. What else? Yeah, Dalia.
About all the sin and cleanup, and how the Jews weren't treating each other well, and how they weren't taking care of the Amanah, the poor people, and all the corruption among the Jewish people before the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed and before the exile.
Right. So that
one of the things that we may have to learn is how to take care of each other.
Right.
And if there's one thing that we're get out of the story of Esther is that we're all in this together, and that we
have to fast and pray for each other, and it's not each man for himself.
Right. So all of this fits within the school of thought that we're being punished, we've done something wrong, and there's a lesson we have to learn, and the lesson that you're identifying is for sure a major part of it. Absolutely. But I'm looking for ideas that have nothing to do with being punished and improving. Yeah, Chana.
Also, for example, for not keeping Shemitah, you got a certain galus, the Aster Teha and Shabto Teha. So obviously, the Kedusha of Eretz Yisrael sometimes doesn't enable us, enable the land to have us on it, because we're not doing what we're supposed to do in the land.
Right. But again, this is all within that school of thought that says that it's that we've done something wrong and that we have to learn something and improve. Rebecca.
I was just going to say, I mean, because you're looking at this gallows that's 50 amot.
Yeah, you're muted. Rebecca, you're muted.
Oh, sorry, I'm not on mute. You're right. Okay, when we look at this gallows that's 50 amot high, when we think about Egypt, we talk about the fact that there are 50 levels of tuma, of impurity, and they reached 49, you know, whatever. I'm wondering whether there's a connection between the two, those 50 there and 50 in both places.
So the mystics do that. They make that 50-50 connection. I wasn't planning on going there, but if you want to look at the Maharal, look at the Chida and Chomat Anach, you will definitely find commentary like that. Rav Kook takes a different school of thought. Rav Kook says the reason why we go into Galut, he writes this in Orot, is because the world is not ready for us to run a country yet. The world has not achieved that point where you can properly run a Torah-based country. It's too barbaric. And so Rav Kook says, we have to go into Galut until the world has perfected itself to the state where we could run a country. You have another approach. The Gemara often, not often, but sometimes suggests that there's a specific thing we're supposed to accomplish in exile besides our own growth. So there's a Gemara in Pesachim that says we go into Galut kidei sheyitosefu aleihen gerim, so that we would gain conversions. By being in exile, people will see us, they're going to be impressed. God, let that happen. We have to do something in order for that to happen. But nonetheless, they're going to be impressed, and then they're going to value what we teach, and they'll value the seven universal laws, and they'll value the mitzvot, and people will join us. That's another school of thought. I want to show you that this... One second, Susan. I want to show you that this 50 Amma gallows actually plays into some of this conversation of what exile is for. Just, Susan, I'm recognizing that it's 2:20, and I want to get through this idea. So I'm going to see what I can do in terms of getting to this idea first. A 50 Amma gallows, a 50 cubit gallows, is, not to make too much of a pun, overkill. The 50 amma. An amma, according to Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, is 21.6 inches. Someone can convert that into meters later on. The 50 amot times 21.6 inches, you're talking about something that is ridiculously tall. Somewhere around 80 feet tall, I think. I didn't do the math. But somewhere around 80 feet tall. Why in the world do you need to kill somebody with a gallows that's 80 feet tall? It doesn't make any sense. Yes, Susan.
I'm answering your question.
Why? Go ahead.
I think it's because you want to show from that height, you're going to see it all over.
Right.
It's a big announcement that I'm telling the world that we did this.
Right.
Everybody knows we got rid of the Jew.
So most answers revolve around visibility, and I'm going to come back to that point. But before we get to that point, I want to build up the question further. Rabbi David Zinsheim, in his Shlal David commentary to the Megillah, notes, Haman goes home after the first party. He was so happy when he left that party. And then he saw Mordechai, and Mordechai doesn't get up. Mordechai doesn't even look scared. And boy, is he angry. And he gets home, and Zeresh and all of his beloved, he tells them, you know, I am awesome. the king loves me. I am so powerful. There's nobody better than I am. I have all these kids and they've got stature. It's incredible. And I don't know what to do. And Zeresh says, well, why don't you just kill him? As Rav David Zinsheim says, that's not exactly a deep insight. Like, why is Haman wowed by, I didn't know what to do. And then I realized, I can kill him? What are you talking about? You can kill an entire nation. That's not news. And Professor Yonatan Grossman notes further, Haman thought about killing Mordechai ages ago. Go back to chapter 3, sentence 6. Vayivez be'enav lishloach yad b'Mordechai levado. When the first time Mordechai wouldn't get up for Haman and wouldn't bow for Haman, right? It said, Haman said, I don't want to just hurt him. I know that he's a Jew, so I'm going to zap all of them. So he already thought about killing Mordechai, and he rejected it as being beneath him. So why is he now open to this idea when Zeresh says, you know, you should kill him? The answer has to be that the height is significant. That's the only thing that's new about her suggestion. So what is it about the height? So as Susan said, most answers revolve around visibility. So if you take a look at the Malbim in source number 7, he floats two ideas. In the interest of time, I'm going to read my English translation. They advised him wisely that he could take revenge against Mordechai, and yet it would not be considered beneath his honor. If he would hang Mordechai only because of his sin of not bowing to him, that would be diminution of his honor. You're the great big vizier of the entire empire. You need to fight with this one lowly Jew. To fight with a Jew for taking his honor lightly, that doesn't look good. But sometimes the king orders to hang one of those who rebel against him to intimidate the nation. And they hang him on a tall piece of wood so the entire nation will see, so that they will see and fear. This wasn't just execute Mordechai because he didn't bow to Haman. This is execute Mordechai as a rebel against the throne. And that is worthy. That's worthy. So the idea of the 50 amot is to make it visible, because that's the way that you hang traitors. Right? Just like they hung Bigtan and Teresh. Right? That's what they, Vayitalu Shnehem al Eitz. Bigtan and Teresh were also hung on a gallows. So that's idea number one, is to make it worthy of Haman. And number two, at the very end, Malbim threw in, to cow future rebels. Also makes it very acceptable to Achashverosh. Shlal David, Rav David Zinsheim in source number 8, throws in an interesting twist. He says it's not just that. If you hang someone on a 50 amma gallows, an 80-foot gallows, he's visible everywhere in Shushan. Haman is supposed to go to the party in the morning, right? That's what's supposed to happen. So she says, Zeresh says to Haman, Uba boker emor lamelech, tell the king in the morning, and they'll hang Mordechai at that time, and therefore, uvoim hamelech elamishte sameach, you can come to the party, all smiles, because you will see Mordechai hanging as you walk into the party. That's the advantage of the height, is that you'll see it. I thought that was a very interesting twist. So this is all one school of thought. It's the visibility that matters. It's going to make it worthy of Haman's time and his honor. It's going to convince Achashverosh to do it when it's seen as a gesture to cow the rebels. That's all one school of thought. Second school of thought, Rav Zinsheim also brings another idea. A medrash, I didn't bring it on your sheet, but I gave you the pasuk reference in source number 9. Breshit Vav Tedvav, Breshit 6:15. Anybody know what that pasuk is describing? Without looking it up, you can look it up if you want. Breshit chapter 6. Okay, fine, look it up. certain chapters, you just have to like keep in mind. It's good to keep them in mind.
Okay. Here it is.
No, chapter 6.
Oh, that's 5, sorry. Chapter 6. Okay, that's Noah. Oh, here it is. V'zeh asher tasel tot shalosh ve'yot ama orech hateva hamishim ama rachba shloshim ama komata.
You got it. It's a description of the dimensions of the teva, of Noah's boat. Noah's boat is 50 cubits wide, 50 ama wide. So says this particular midrash, which Rabbi David Zinsheim quotes. What happened was, one of Noah's sons got him this piece of wood from Mount Ararat, where the Teva rested at the end of the flood, and brought it to him to use to hang Mordechai. What in the world would be the connection between Noah's boat and hanging Mordechai? Yes. So Susan says, it's 50. Here's 50. Here's 50. That was easy. Right? It's 50 and 50. And the truth of the matter is, I think that's mostly what this midrash is doing. It's just saying, wood that's 50 amos long is not so easy to come by. And hey, we have a piece of wood that's 50 amos long in the Teva. The Shlal David suggests that maybe Haman would have viewed it as a religious relic. And, you know, it has some kind of power because it's from the boat. Like the people who built the boat in Kentucky, right? They built the replica in, it's Kentucky, right? That has the new one. So that's an interesting approach. But then there's another idea, and I wanted to spend time on this, but it's clearly going to happen next time at this point. But I'll just show you the pasuk. In source number 9, I gave you a reference to a pasuk from Malachim Aleph Perek Zayin. That's another one of those chapters that people should be aware of. It's from the construction of the first Beit HaMikdash, the first temple. And there we find out that, again, 50 amot wide. You had beams that ran the 50 cubit width of the Beit HaMikdash. And so the Medrash in Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer in source number 10 suggests that this piece of wood came from the temple, came from the Beit HaMikdash. So the question that we're going to ask, and we'll start with God willing next time, is why? Is this just another case of there's 50 here, there's 50 there, right? It's like some people when they make a shidduch. He's single, she's single. Okay, so let's set them up. There's 50 amma piece of wood there, there's a 50 amma piece of wood here. Why not assume it's the same piece of wood? But we're going to see a potential message emerge from the idea that he's using wood from the Beit HaMikdash, from the temple, and it will connect to our discussion of what the purpose of exile is. So we'll have to wrap that up next time. So what we saw this time, and Susan, I'm sorry that I wasn't able to take your question before. I guess I could have, because I didn't end up finishing the topic anyway. We started out by talking about the importance of taking practical steps. How even though Esther starts out from a religious frame, nonetheless she persists from a practical frame, and with all of these different practical ways that she wants to trap Haman, to manipulate Achashverosh, to manipulate the Jews, to get God to do what she wants. Then we talked about why the second party, and we said there are practical benefits to it in terms of intensifying what she developed in the first party, as well as in terms of the request being at Achashverosh's command, plus Ibn Ezra, she gets a sign from God, Mordechai parading around the city. That's what she's looking for. And then we talked about why this idea of hanging Mordechai in such a tall piece of wood appeals to her. We saw some basic answers about the visibility, and we'll come back to it, God willing, next week. Okay?
Can I ask you my question?
Yes, please do.
Thank you very much.
Those who can stay can stay. But yeah, Susan, what's your question?
I'm very confused because I learned from all my rabbis at school that your Jews didn't look to convert non-Jews. We had to send them away 3 times, show them all the bad stuff. So why would Rav Kook say we want to do
so
that?
So two things. Right, so good question. It's not Rav Kook who says it, it's the Gemara that says it.
Okay, the Gemara.
Yeah, Rav Kook had a different idea. But you're asking the right question. I thought we don't encourage conversion. The answer is we don't encourage conversion, but we do want people to convert. Meaning, we're very concerned about somebody joining insincerely. And so we make sure to question and to challenge and that they really know what they're getting into and that they want to do it before we would take anybody. However, if someone really sincerely wants to, we embrace them wholeheartedly and we view it as a benefit for the Jewish people and for the world.
Well, for them, the Torah always says how we treat a
proselyte. Yes.
Thank you.
Yeah.
How we treat them, like with respect, and you keep them in, and